Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding, your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning. We are here this morning on rules hearings. 2304 is the first up to bat. That is in the matter of modification of SCR Chapter 10, Regulation of the State Bar. Presenter is Margaret Hickey, past president, State Bar of Wisconsin. Bring my other one.
Good morning, Chief Justice Ziegler and members of the court. May it please the court. We, the State Bar of Wisconsin, have filed a petition to modify the rule that currently would add a voting member to the Board of Governors from the Section Leaders Council. With me here today on behalf of the State Bar, our President, Dean Dietrich, our President-elect, Jane Booker, also Dennis Puz in the middle, who is currently the representative of the Section Leaders Council on the Board of Governors. Next to him, Randy Brotherhood, who is the current chair of the Section Leaders Council. And, of course, I believe you know our executive director, Larry Martin, our chief financial officer, Paul Marshall, and Lisa Royce, who is our general manager of advocacy. Also in the room today is our counsel, Roberta Howell, in case we need any help from her. So, this petition has been under consideration by the Board of Governors for probably almost 20 years. That's a little hard to believe, but things move slowly. And as the summary that we provided to you of the Board of Governors and Executive Committee meetings show, the matter was considered and voted on the Board of Governors by the Board of Governors with Governor Zales participating in April of 2017. And that was a vote of 41-1 in favor of the petition. For a number of reasons, including litigation that we were involved in concerning the bar itself and whether the bar should remain a mandatory bar, we did not bring a petition at that time. Over the past several years, we have had a representative from the Section Leaders Council, and I'll refer to it as SLC if that's okay, attend our Board of Governors meetings, but without voting privileges. We believe it is important for the Section Leader Council member to have voting privileges due to the number of members of the State Bar who participate in sections. So over 7,700 of our members are member of at least one section, and over 14,000 members participate in sections total, so some are a member of more than one section. The members of the Section Leader Council are chosen by each of the sections, and we have 24 sections. They are elected individuals who serve on that Section Leaders Council, and then the Section Leader Council would pick its chair, I believe, and the chair or vice chair of the board is the individual who's been serving on the Board of Governors, but without a vote over the last few years. So this is a person who is essentially in an elected position and representing section members. And I chaired a task force, it's probably 10 years ago now, to look at how we can make the sections more integrated in the bar, how we can make sure that they are fully participating. And I'm sure you know that sections are mandatory under the rule SCR 10.054. So we wanted to make sure that sections, who are a very vibrant place in the state bar and who do a lot of the substantive work of the state bar, would be fully integrated and participating at the Board of Governors level. So why did we think it was important? Well, the large number of members who participate in sections, the importance of the substantive work that's done by sections, and the need to have those sections then well integrated and participating at the Board of Governors level. So after the 2017 vote, this matter came back before the Board of Governors in a package of modifications to SCR Chapter 10 and the State Bar Bylaws, and it included the exact same issue, having a Section Leader Council representative on the board who would have a vote. And that came before us in a meeting in the 2020 and 2021 year. In June of 2020, we had a discussion of the issue, and Mr. Zales, who made essentially an objection to this petition, was at that meeting. He was attending as a guest because he was coming in the next fiscal year for the State Bar in the fall of 2021, but he was in attendance, and we had a final vote, I believe, in September 9 of 2020. It was not done on the consent agenda. It was done following the usual method that we do at the board, and the board, it is not a formal requirement, but we have an informal policy of having reporting on the issue at one meeting, discussion at the next meeting, and then argument at the third meeting, or I say argument, a vote or action at the third meeting. So we followed that procedure in this case, in that 2020 to 2021 series of board meetings.
And was that followed in the April 2017 meeting too, June?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, it was, Madam Justice. So then we followed that procedure, and the vote in the fall of 2020, I believe, I hope I get these years right, was unanimous in favor of the petition. There was no objection. None.
Did Attorney Zales vote, was he a voting member at that point?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. He was.
And it wasn't part of a consent agenda.
It was not on the consent agenda. Correct. It was on the regular agenda. And just to be clear, when we do a consent agenda, we include all of the materials. The materials are extensive, but we gave you a description of the Board of Governors' duties, and one of the Board of Governors' duties as members is to read the materials. And the consent agenda we got each time, if it was on the consent agenda, the entire bylaws and rules changes. But in September of 2020, it was not on the consent agenda. It was on the regular agenda.
And it was, when you have the changes, they're redlined, right? I saw what was attached.
Like, usually,
so if someone was just even skimming their materials,
correct,
they would see the redline change.
Yes, correct, Justice Dallet.
And this was redlined?
Yes. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. After that vote, the governance committee, so the Board of Governors has three main committees. One is governance. And the governance committee decided it needed a few additional changes to these recommended changes to the rules and bylaws. They were minor. They were changes like making things gender neutral, you know, not having a he or she, but just saying the member. They were very
non-substantive, correct?
I'm sorry?
Non-substantive, correct?
Exactly, Your Honor, not substantive. So those then did come up in the June 2021 meeting on the consent agenda. The petition we have before you was already approved by the Board of Governors unanimously.
So the purpose of just putting it on a consent agenda is just to, because they're just non-substantive, just to kind of push it through because everyone had already voted on the substance, including Mr. Zales.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so those additions were on the consent agenda, and that matter was approved through the consent agenda. However, let me point out, I think it's important to know how we proceed at our meetings. If any member of the Board of Governors objects to something being on the consent agenda, they simply raise their hand, say they object, and it's taken off. And Mr. Zales and I have been together on the Board of Governors for going on 20 years. We've served not always at exactly the same times, but I have seen Mr. Zales personally many times ask to remove something from the consent agenda. So he could have done that, but he did not do that. And you know, I'm not sure why not, but he did not. So the matter was then approved, unchanged throughout the process. The materials were available to all of us at each and every single one of the meetings, including the meeting where we passed the modifications that were minor by consent agenda. The matter of adding a voting member from the Section Leaders Council to the Board of Governors has been under consideration literally for more than a decade and has been approved by multiple boards of governors. And in each case, there was one objection, as I mentioned, in 2017.
It's my understanding the proposal was first approved about 20 or going on 20 years ago. Why wasn't a rule petition brought until now?
That is an excellent question, Your Honor, and I think the problem is that other things intervened. We were involved in litigation.
20 years?
Boards change. Timing is important. Sometimes we have other things before you that we don't want to just send a million things up before the court. Sometimes we're ourselves as a Board of Governors very involved in litigation and we're focusing on that. So it wasn't up for a vote, a full vote, I don't believe, till 2017. But you're right. It was percolating a long time.
I thought June 9, 2021 was when the bylaw amendments occurred.
I would argue, Your Honor, that it occurred at the September 2020 meeting and that minor tweaks, again, just language modifications were made in that 2021 meeting.
Okay. There's a rule that requires you to bring these matters before the court when the bylaw changes are made. So when did that rule, when was that invoked? When was the bylaw change made such that you would be bringing this before the court? I thought it was June.
Well, the complete package, that is correct, Your Honor. The complete package with those minor amendments was approved in June of 2021. Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought. So that was by consent agenda?
The final approval, yes.
Okay, so that's what he's, I think, talking about. There's been this pattern of doing nothing, really, for 20 years, and then this is in a 300-and-some-odd-page consent agenda and passed in June of 2021, I think, right?
And I think if that is how it had happened, there would be perhaps a legitimate but over the course, and I brought the history, if you want, I can go through it with you. Since 2017, this matter has been on the regular agenda probably 5, 6, 7 times, each time with the full package of changes, each time with all the red line changes available to all of the Board of Governors members. So while it's true that the final proposal was approved in June of 2021 on the consent agenda, it had been approved by the full board numerous, several times before that.
Okay.
At what point was it on the agenda as an item for discussion?
It was on the agenda as an item for discussion in the June 2020 meeting, and it was on for action in that September 2021 meeting. But I have with me the full history, and if you want, I can go back through a number of times this issue was on the agenda of the Board of Governors as either discussion, reporting, or action.
How many times does the composition, or how often does the composition of the board change?
There is a changeover every year in the Board of Governors membership.
So did the most recent board have notice and approve this change, or was it, as Attorney Zales says, kind of buried in the 300-plus pages that were presented, and it was not highlighted, he's alleging, not highlighted as an issue? I guess the question is, were there newer board members who didn't really know what they were voting on?
Not in that year, Your Honor, no. Because
what year?
The year 2020 to 2021. So that's the year that this was finalized and brought to the final approval by the Board of Governors. That would be the same year starting in September of 2020 through June of 2021. It is the same exact board.
But the most recent board has not voted on this proposal.
Well, it's our position, our policy at the Board of Governors that we can carry forward from one board to another previously approved matters. So, they were on notice. The board has been on notice that this is before you and that we are arguing it and that it was approved by a prior board, but we have not re-voted on it, if that is your question.
Go ahead.
Are you okay?
Go ahead, Chief. In June of 2021, a series of amendments were made to the bylaws, right?
In June of 2021?
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. Those are the ones that were, as I described, minor.
Okay. But they still went through the process of 10-13 sub 2 being noticed and filed and done in that manner?
Yes, Your Honor.
But not this one?
We have gone through the process that we are required to for notice on any bylaw changes or any rule changes. We have done that consistently.
Well, I mean, the rule says when any change in the bylaws has been made by the Board of Governors, blah, 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 it's Rule 10.13 sub 2. It basically says when it's made, then we go through this process. Now, we're on this one part of the changes that were made. The others were filed fairly promptly. This one wasn't. It's 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Why wait 2 years when the other ones that were approved in the bylaws were done?
Okay. So Ms. Royce is informing me that, and I'm not as intimately familiar with all the procedures, I apologize, but we have published this particular, these changes to the bylaws. We have not published the entire changes because not all of them are before you. In fact, those that were voted on multiple years ago have still not been brought to this court. And honestly, I had said earlier, we've had a lot of litigation, as you know. And so we have had, I've been on the Board of Governors the last 5 or 6 years. We've had 3 or 4 lawsuits pending against the Board of Governors, and those have taken a great deal of our time and attention. And so we have not brought this forward. That's true.
But you have brought other rule petitions before the court in that time.
Yes, Your Honor, we have. I would say, and I'm not familiar with all of them, but many of them have been relatively routine. I can't give you an exact reason why this one was delayed, except to say that it wasn't front and center. And I'll be, you know, tell you that one of the reasons that brought it front and center for us as a Board of Governors is we had some fairly contentious issues in the last year and a half, and Mr. Puz, who represents the Section Leaders Council, said, why can't I vote? And we said, because we haven't gotten this up before the court yet, so we decided we'd better get this before you.
That was my question. I know there are a lot of procedural questions that my colleagues and I have, but I'm interested in the substance of this. Why? Why should we vote in favor of this rule? Why is it important? Why does it help the state bar and its membership?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think, as I said earlier, it's the large number of our members who participate in sections. And I would argue that this is similar to the representatives that we have from Senior Law Division, Government Lawyers Division, Young Lawyers Division, and Non-Resident Lawyers Division, all of whom have voting members on our Board of Governors. And, you know, in the last 10 years, the non-resident lawyers went from 3 voting members to 5 voting members to better represent the people who are the members that are non-resident. So section members are a critical, large part of the state bar, and we want them to have a voice. And sometimes their voice really is different. I have been chair of 2 sections, family law and the elder law and special needs section, and section members don't always agree with what's happening at the Board of Governors level, and they want to have a voice. They want to be able to say, hey, Board of Governors, you're moving this way or that way, but we think maybe you should either slow down or maybe you should take different action, and right now they don't really have a voice as sections.
So my question is, if we have concerns about the procedure and we have concerns about the delay, and we would decide we need to deny the petition, what's your next step? Do you revote and bring it back, or tell us what you would do?
Well, I would ask the court for direction. If the problem is that you feel that the delay of 2 years or we could certainly take it back to the Board of Governors and have it voted on again. You know, there's no problem with that. I just would like to know from the state bar's point of view what's the problem so we can fix it. We want to make sure we're doing things right, obviously.
And it sounds to me as though the proposal has overwhelming support, including Attorney Zale's support, correct?
Correct. He has in the past. Now, I want to be really straight.
I'm not so sure about that. I read his article from the other one.
No, he did vote against it. He did vote against it back in 2017. He did not vote against it in 2021. The letter that he has written both to the court and as a recent letter to the editor says he disagrees with our process. I don't know that he disagrees with Section Leaders Council having a vote. He disagrees with the way that we went about it, which is the focus of many of your questions. So that, I think that is the...
What's the harm in taking it back for a vote?
I'm sorry?
What's the harm in taking it back for a vote? If that makes people feel like the process is more transparent and open and... there's this perception or feeling he's written strong remarks even as late as yesterday. He's not here today. I understand he has court or car trouble or something like that, but he stands by his statements. What's the harm of just the board meets, bring it up, have it highlighted, debate it, and vote, and you probably win? And he said, even in his writing yesterday, if that would happen, he abides by that. But it sure doesn't seem like he's on board necessarily with it.
So, Your Honor, we have voted on it twice. We had 1 vote against, and otherwise we had a unanimous vote. Yes, we can take it back, but it's 3 more meetings. Okay, we meet in February, we meet in April, I believe we meet in June, so we could get it done this year. Then we'd be looking at filing a petition again. confront exactly the same issue. And I guess what I would say is, while Mr. Zales objected, and he has every right to object, the other 39 or 40 or 41 people have no problem with the method that we have engaged and used here. So Mr. Zales has every right to object, but that does not mean that we didn't follow proper procedure. We did. We followed proper procedure. And so to take it back for the purpose of taking it back is busy work, to be honest with you. It takes up time of the Board of Governors, and it feels, like a bit frustrating. We can do it. Of course we can do it.
And does it delay the ultimate goal of what you're trying to achieve here, which is giving these section leaders a voice on the Board of Governors?
Of course it would. We would have to refile the petition. It would come into your next fall session or whenever, and then we would essentially another year would go by without a representative, a voting representative on the Section Leaders Council. Yes, correct.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. We hope that you will vote in favor of the petition. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other people who would like to be heard on this matter? And I would note, just so we're clear, as far as a record, we do have the objection and filing of Attorney Zales, and it is my understanding that he wanted to be here to speak. It's not like he's withdrawing that commentary. And so the court can consider it as if he were here today, but he's just not here, I understand.
How do we know
is that in the record somewhere that he wasn't?
Is it in the record somewhere that he wanted to be here? And
I had my staff call and see, because the agenda's changed 3 times. And as chief, it's important to know who's going to be speaking, if possible. We always open it up for other people.
So he didn't reach out to say
and
that he wanted to be here?
No. Okay. No. Well, I don't know the answer to that. I think Sue asked, don't put me under oath here, but my understanding is that the person who lines this up, Sue called that person, and that person said that he called and said he had car trouble, but he stands by his comments.
Okay, so he had work or car trouble?
I said car
Three members of the staff are administrative staff are nodding their heads in agreement for the record.
Am I wrong? If I'm wrong, please let me
know.
I'm not trying to say
something that's
inaccurate.
No, I just want to be clear how we know.
The person who lines up the agenda, we got another modification as of today, and I wondered why.
Thank you.
Because we have someone who, as of yesterday, wrote a commentary in the Wisconsin Law Journal objecting. And then I get an agenda first thing this morning saying he's not here. Okay. So I had Sue ask, why is it he's not here? Because it's important if someone withdraws their objection and doesn't want us to consider their commentary.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything wrong about what I said? Okay. Because if it is inaccurate, I want it to be accurate above all. So, okay. All right, then. Unless anyone else wishes to be heard on this matter, we can conclude this and move on.
We're doing the second one. I need my binder.
All right, 2305, in the matter of proposed rules relating to appellate court proceedings from orders entered pursuant to WISSTAT 971.14 regarding pretrial competency rulings in criminal case. I have Katie York first speaking as the presenter.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Katie York. I'm the acting state public defender, and I'm going to do a short presentation on the proposed rule for appeal judgment competency criminal cases. I'll give you a little bit of a roadmap of what I plan on talking about, and then I'll jump into it, but please feel free to jump in with questions at any point.
Can I just jump in really quickly? I've seen different language
pretrial and prejudgment. Are they being used interchangeably, or can you clarify that for me,
please? Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Good question. We are using the term prejudgment because potentially the competency issue could come up post-trial, pre-sentencing.
So that's that again? It could come up
post-trial, pre-sentencing. So it would be prejudgment.
That would be someone who's on probation, in the probation?
No, I wasn't thinking probation. I was just thinking between sentencing or even a plea on a case and
Before sentencing.
Before sentencing. So trial or a plea, and then you have a delay before sentencing. Competency could be raised before sentencing. And so that's why it's prejudgment as opposed to pretrial.
All right. And what I would
say,
does
that make sense?
Attorney York, my concern about that, and I've given that a bit of thought, is prejudgment, I'm fine with that during trial. But if, in fact, someone's convicted, then you've got the judgment, right? The judgment of conviction. So that lapse between a conviction and a potential sentencing, do you think we need a different word?
We're not going to have the judgment of conviction until after sentencing. The judgment of conviction won't be entered until sentencing.
Well, a judgment of conviction will be entered on the record if the person's found guilty, even though I know the actual document isn't generated until the sentence is run.
Sure.
I think we just need to be clear about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And really the distinction that we wanted to make was we're talking about, this rule talks about cases before sentencing, as opposed to post-conviction proceedings, which is what was at issue with Scott and Deborah A.E., and we're not, this rule doesn't apply to those post-conviction proceedings. So that's the distinction that we were working on. Okay. So I was just going to give you guys a little bit of background of kind of how we came about working on this rule at the Judicial Council Appellate. We have colleagues from the Department of Justice who will come up and kind of give their perspective from their point of view. I'm just going to touch on some of the key points in the rule that I think probably are most relevant, the expedited process, the limited stay for involuntary medication orders, confidentiality piece. I just want to emphasize kind of a theme here of collaboration. I think it's really important to note that the committee that worked on this proposed rule, obviously I was there from the State Public Defender's Office, but we also have representatives from Department of Justice, Department of Health Services, and the Court of Appeals. And as you guys can imagine, sometimes we don't always agree on things. We had some debate about some of the provisions in this rule, and we really worked hard together to come up with a rule that we all felt worked best for all of our relevant perspectives. For the SPD, certainly that's our clients. So the origins of this project really came from increased litigation about competency in criminal cases, and that started happening around 2018, 2019 with Scott and Fitzgerald, and we started seeing these cases coming in from the trial court, and quite frankly, it was pretty chaotic. It's chaotic because there oftentimes is an involuntary medication order, and there really is this race to the courts to try to figure out stay litigation. Should we stay this order? Should we not stay this order? And without a set process, what happened was we would try to educate our attorneys, both private bar and staff public defenders, that they would come to either me or one of our appellate managers right away, and we would have all the forms, the notice of appeal, whatever motion regarding the stay they would need to file, and walk them through what they had to do in the circuit court. Usually those circuit court proceedings would happen pretty quickly, and if that stay was denied, then we were kind of racing to the Court of Appeals to file an emergency stay motion. Oftentimes the Court of Appeals would grant the stay initially, and then would ask for briefing about the issue so the court could get up to speed on kind of what happened at the circuit court. The state could have someone respond. We could get an appellate attorney on the case to kind of litigate the stay issue. So usually there was some sort of pause before there was a final decision on the stay. But it was quite chaotic right out of the gate because we were dealing with a person who was potentially going to be involuntarily medicated. DHS was in a position where, you know, hey, we're going to file this motion to stay the involuntary med order, so we would contact DHS, but there was a period where, you know, obviously the court has to decide the order, and there were concerns about, okay, what if we medicate, and then the stay is granted, and we're going to stop the medication. That's a problem.
Yeah, Attorney, just a quick question. Why did this all of a sudden start like 4 years ago? I mean, people have been going to trial for a pretty long time.
Yeah.
And so just, I mean, I don't have any sense for why this all of a sudden became an issue.
Yeah, I will take responsibility on behalf of litigants in the state of Wisconsin. I think we were all doing it incorrectly. And until Scott and Fitzgerald came out and said, hey, look at Zell versus United States, we're not litigating these correctly, did people start to realize, like, oh, no, we aren't doing this right. And so that kind of spurred the litigation. And so I think people are just much more aware of the process that needs to be filed for these types of cases. And I will, just anecdotally, I'll also add, I think there is an increase in the number of mentally ill people in the criminal justice system that are being found incompetent. And of course, that's anecdotal, but I'm hearing that from my staff around the state. So as we have more mentally ill people that are charged with crime that are incompetent, we're going to kind of see an uptick in these kinds of cases.
Why would that be? Is it just because there's more maybe awareness of the issue and it's an argument that can be made, or there's more, you know, I mean, you know, people have been around for a long time.
right. I can't answer the question of why we have more mentally ill people in the criminal system that are found to be incompetent. I think awareness is a big piece of the increased litigation on the involuntary med issue. And by increased litigation, certainly there is an increase. It's still not a huge number of cases, right? It's not like our Chapter 51 cases where you guys in the Court of Appeals are seeing a lot of litigation in Chapter 51. The quantity of cases still is fairly low comparatively, but it's enough to create a lot of chaos when it comes up. And part of the problem is because it's not coming up so frequently, people don't know what to do. And so every time you're kind of having to walk someone through the process, whereas if you have an established rule, it makes it a lot easier to understand the process.
So prior to even some of that increased litigation with the Scott Fitzgerald, et cetera, what happened? Was it just there weren't many of these motions that were filed, or because the standard was maybe thought of as lower, it was not granted as much, or there were just, what practically happened before all of this started being debated?
I think a lot of courts were not following Sell. And I think on the defense side, people weren't raising that issue.
I see.
I think it was kind of more of a matter of course.
Okay. Thank you.
So the way that would play out is someone would bring up competency in a trial court. Yeah, it could be anyone. Could be usually the defense attorney, but could be the prosecutor.
We're seeing it more with the prosecutor in the court because it's happening at intake.
Okay. So, but to get to what Justice Hagedorn was talking sort of before Scott, what would happen if someone would bring forth a competency question, right? Mm-hmm. Judge would find the defendant not competent.
Mm-hmm.
Then would order meds, yes? Perhaps?
Perhaps, yeah. Not always,
To bring the person back to competency in this certain type of situation. And then there wouldn't be any stay, so that person would be ordered to take the meds involuntarily while the case was being litigated, yes?
Yes, yeah. I mean, what was happening before is I don't think there were a lot of appeals from that involuntary med order.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that was a big game changer.
Yes.
Is once the public defender's office started to take a look at what was happening with those involuntary med orders, and then it started this line of cases, I think.
Yes. Yes, I think that's fair. Yes, and to be fair, we have we've done quite a bit of training and education on competency issues, including involuntary medication orders. So attorneys are much more aware of the issue. they're aware of Sell, Fitzgerald, and how the process should be working. And so that's why these issues are being raised more often.
Counsel, you've used terms like increase, quantitatively low. So how many of these hearings, these medication hearings, is the state public defender seeing per year? Number one, and the second question is, if you know, how long are the transcripts? There's some concern, I think, about the court reporters getting transcripts done. So are you able to enlighten us with more precise information?
Yeah, I don't have definitive numbers on the number of competency cases that we have. It's kind of a difficult thing to track, although I will say I had a manager show me a list of, I think, 400 or 500 cases in Milwaukee County that have competency issues. So it's significant. But I can tell you on the appellate side of it, we're seeing, I've used the term handful, I've been corrected, it's not handful, it's more like three handfuls. So about 8 to 15 a year where we're seeing the appeals. So much higher quantity of competency proceedings in the trial court, and then a fraction of those are being appealed.
And maybe being appealed less now that people are following Sell.
Yeah, I mean, I think hopefully, the more clarification that the lower courts are provided, the more likely that things will go in a direction where appeals aren't necessary.
Do the 400 to 500 that you're talking about in Milwaukee, are all of those cases with involuntary medication orders, or that's the whole?
No, this
that's
was
the universe.
And yeah, just to clarify, this is just, I was in a manager's office and she said, here's a list that we have of competency cases. So I don't know how long they were there. I wouldn't say that they all had involuntary medication.
I think Justice Inwash Bradley asked you a question of the transcripts and what you anticipate as the length of transcripts. And I can remember both my time in the Dane County DA's office and on the bench in Dane County presiding over competency hearings. They're not days-long trials. Often often there's a stipulation to the report of the expert.
Yeah.
They're not long. I mean, some
right.
I shouldn't say they can't be long, but very often they're, I don't know, not more than an hour or two, even if they're contested.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, as we're kind of being more robust with these hearings, maybe they'll be a little bit longer, but they're not full-day hearings. They're shorter transcripts.
Well, you also narrowed this. They don't have to complete the whole transcript. You said the portion, right? Isn't it just the portion of the proceeding that involves the ordering of the involuntary medication?
So we have a bifurcated process, right? So there could be situations where there's an appeal of the competency decision, but there isn't an involuntary med order that's being appealed. So we expedited the process when there's an involuntary med order.
Right.
And so that the court reporter would have 14 days to do just that transcript. And if there are other transcripts that relate to competency and not the medication order, then they'd have kind of the longer period. And the whole purpose of having that quick turnaround for the involuntary medication transcript is so we can do the stay litigation. And then if there are other transcripts unrelated to the medication order, then it's that, I think it's a 30-day timeline that's consistent with what we do in TPR cases.
So that portion that's expedited is even shorter than that entire hearing. So.
Yeah. Yep.
And do you know how many transcripts a year we're talking about?
Well, if we have 8 to 15 appeals a year, or, you know, kind of a couple handfuls of appeals, it would be something in that ballpark.
And you talked, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You can follow up.
You talked about the bifurcated transcript. Approximately how long are these transcripts, if you know?
I think most hearings are about an hour, maybe 2 hours, so I should know this better than I do, but I would say 30 to 60 pages.
Because you're in management now.
I would say similar to what you see in a final hearing for a Chapter 51 proceeding. That length would be a good comparable.
I want to ask you about I'm looking at 2F of the rule, amended rule. And this is where the heading is filing and service of transcript and circuit court case record. And I'm just trying to figure out the timing here. You see where I am?
Yep.
So what I see is that if there's an involuntary med order, then the subject of the order or counsel shall within 3 days request a transcript.
Okay. Yes.
And then at the very bottom it says the court reporter shall file the transcript with the court within 14 days of that request. So that's 17 days.
Yes.
But you're asking for a 14-day stay initially of the medication order. So I'm not that good at math because I went to law school. But this confused me.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point, because when I was doing the math yesterday, I was kind of working through this. So I get what you're saying. So the defense attorney has 3 days to request the transcript. They also have 14 days to file the notice of intent and the motion notifying the court that they want a continued stay. So they're... If we take it to the extreme, it could potentially be 17 days before we get the transcript, but the notice of intent and that notice saying, hey, we want to continue the stay pending the stay litigation will be on the 14 days. So that 14 days, the notice of intent deadline matches up with when you have to ask for the continued stay. But it could be an additional 3 days potentially where we get the transcript. So the total amount of time for the stay litigation, if my math is correct, would be 53 days if everything was at the end.
Okay. Understood. Thank you.
Okay, well, you guys touched on a lot of the stuff that I was going to touch on today. I would just point out that, the basis of the rule, really, we didn't recreate the wheel with any of this. We pulled from 809.30 and 809.107 because those are the case types that we usually use for public defender cases. It allows for the appointment of counsel. The TPR statute, 809.107, has that expedited process, which pretty early on in our work on this draft rule, we decided an expedited process was needed. The other issue I wanted to touch on.
Can I just ask you one more question on timing? Sorry. What if this court is the holdup?
What if this court is what?
Is the holdup? What if we're not able to move as quickly? What if a case gets to us in June when we're not in July, in the end of June, and we're not going to sit for a case until September? Like, what happens to all of the states? I don't understand.
Sure.
It seems like that throws a wrench into all of this, potentially.
Yeah.
Well, or do you just keep asking
the problem,
for extensions?
So I don't, the premise is off. But
right.
So I think what would happen, so at the point where you have a court of appeals decision, so the court now has a decision by the time it comes to you guys, and the decision is going to say one way or the other, yes, we think things went well, no, we don't, right? And I would imagine if there was a stay that was granted early on before the Court of Appeals weighed in on the case fully, the state could potentially ask to lift that stay after the Court of Appeals decision. Now we have the Court of Appeals that has said everything was okay. And so maybe now there's a reason to lift the stay at that point if there's that expediency. I certainly would ask my colleagues from the Department of Justice to weigh in on that. You seem skeptical, Justice Hagedorn.
Oh, no, maybe I always have a quizzical look in my face. No, but I think that... I was just thinking about whether we're not going to cause any problems, just thinking of Justice Karofsky's question.
We don't ever cause any problems.
Yeah. I mean, the most important thing here is just to get these things sorted out and have a clear process right at the end of the day. And, is this going to open up a bunch of emergency appeals to us about these questions? I don't know that it would more than the normal process, but that was the only thing I was just pondering in my brain a little bit, because we're not equipped to act quickly, and we don't do that very well, because that's not what we're designed to do. The Court of Appeals can do it much more efficiently than us.
Yeah, and I wouldn't imagine that it would require some sort of emergency litigation, even if there was some sort of, and quite frankly, I don't know that we had talked about this piece with this court. I don't know that it would be emergency litigation the way it is at the front end with the Court of Appeals, because at that point, there's no order, or there's an order in place and you're trying to get the state litigation. The flip side isn't going to have the same emergent situation. Okay. I think that's probably, oh, I'm sorry, just if there's time. The one other piece I wanted to touch on really quickly is the confidentiality piece, which that's not really the right way to term it because it's not fully confidential, but we agreed that what would be best is to use initials, because the subject of the appeal is really all about their private mental health issues. You know, competency reports are confidential within the criminal case. That's usually what we're talking about. And so we wanted some sort of anonymity. The public can still have access to it. Victims can still have access to it. But really, you won't be able to go into the appellate CCAP, put in the person's name, and have a brief pop-up and say, okay, here's all this person's very private information about their mental health issue. The other thing is in published decisions, right? So we won't have a published decision with a person's name on it, you know, detailing some of the mental health issues that they suffer from. So that was kind of the point of it, kind of balancing, you know, the need for the public to know about criminal proceedings with the kind of unique nature of these cases.
Counsel, what about the title?
About
the title of this proposed change. Do we need a title, and if so, what should it be?
Oh. That's a good question. I'd have to look at what we have for titles in 809-107 and 809-30. Did we come up with a title? No. I can...
Maybe it could be something like appeals from orders under 971.14.
Yes. Brilliant. Yes.
And catchy.
And catchy, yeah. Just fold off the tongue.
Super catchy.
I will, and I can ponder that while my colleagues are talking, but yes, I something along those lines. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Kara Jansen.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kara Jansen on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Justice. I'll try to be quick this morning. I just want to underscore the importance of this rule from the state's perspective, particularly when we're viewing this through an appellate lens, and then my colleague will briefly talk about things from a trial perspective, and of course, happy to answer any questions that you might have. The state just gets one opportunity to treat a defendant to competency, and we have at most 12 months to do that. It's less than 12 months depending on the maximum penalty that the defendant faces. And if we're unsuccessful in that 12-month period, the result is that the criminal proceedings are suspended and the defendant is released into the community subject to a Chapter 51 or a 55 proceeding. But of course, as this court knows, that's the county's prerogative. The state can't control whether a Chapter 51 or a 55 is initiated. So in that situation where we're not successful in restoring competency, our only hope for a continued prosecution and to seek justice for the victim is if the defendant one day becomes competent on his own. So it's not an ideal situation for us and for the victims and for the public, particularly when we're dealing with a serious crime. So given all of that, given that we have this 12-month clock, given that we get only one shot at restoring competency, any delay in treatment because of an appeal of a treatment order is potentially problematic for the state, right? We want a meaningful opportunity to be able to treat someone to competency. And I was here a couple years ago in State v. Green explaining this problem to the court. If this court would recall, Green dealt with the automatic stay of involuntary medication orders pending appeal that this court created through its superintending authority in State v. Scott. As we explained back then, the problem with that automatic stay is that we were being prevented from immediately being able to provide treatment that an expert had said is necessary and likely to restore competency within the time allotted, all the while our 12-month clock was ticking away. Now, there was a mechanism in place for us to be able to move to lift the stay, but that effort in and of itself took time off of our clock, and if we weren't successful in lifting the stay, that meant our hands were tied during the pendency of the appeal. We were not able to provide the medication that an expert said, again, likely and necessary to restore competency. Now we initially in Green proposed what we thought was an equitable solution to this problem, which was to toll our 12-month clock, the 12 months in the statute, to restore trial competency whenever there was a Scott stay, whenever there was a stay of an involuntary medication order. If I recall, no justice seemed particularly wild about that idea. I think I lost 7-0, not that I'm still thinking about it. But at questioning at oral argument, the focus shifted to, well, should the automatic stay that we created in Scott be limited to the post-conviction competency setting, not the pre-judgment setting? We took a closer look at things. We saw the writing on the wall with tolling. And so we asked this court, yes, please limit the automatic stay to the post-conviction competency setting. So as the law currently stands, as Attorney York was explaining, if we get an involuntary medication order connected to a competency proceeding in the pre-judgment context, it is not automatically stayed pending the defendant's appeal. And I can say that Green has been helpful in the sense that, in theory, we're able to immediately provide the treatment that the expert has said is necessary and likely to restore competency. And we don't have to waste time off our clock trying to undo the automatic stay. That said, Green has not been a perfect solution for us, I think for at least a couple reasons. First, of course, the defendant still has the opportunity to move to obtain a stay of the involuntary medication order. And if he is successful in getting that, we are back to the situation where our hands are tied during the duration of the appeal, and these appeals can and often do take over a year to resolve. And just to give you a sense of things, I pulled the last two decisions that I've had on involuntary medication orders in this context, the prejudgment context, and from the date of the commitment and treatment order in one of them to the date of the Court of Appeals decision was nearly 2.5 years. And in another case, it was just over a year. So considering our 12-month clock, this can be potentially very problematic, which is why I really want to highlight how important it is from our perspective to fast-track these appeals. The other reason why I think Green hasn't been a perfect solution is Attorney York touched on a little bit ago, which is that practically speaking, eliminating the automatic stay in the pre-judgment context has created some pretty chaotic situations for the bench and bar and for the treatment providers at DHS. If the circuit court, after ordering the involuntary medication, doesn't stay the order, it's a race to the Court of Appeals, it's an emergency motion for temporary relief, nobody has a transcript to be able to tell what happened, and the Court of Appeals is in a really difficult spot of having to make a very quick decision without a lot of information, and obviously it's a very important decision. It's involving bodily integrity. So, and the state really has no say in it because of how quickly it's going and the fact that we really don't know what went on because we don't have a transcript. On the other side of things, you have the treatment providers at DHS who have an order that says that they can begin treatment, but they know that it is not good for the patient to start and stop medication. So they're in this position of deciding, do we start medication, thinking there may be an emergency motion for a stay, thinking a stay may ultimately be obtained. We don't want to start and stop medication. So we have taken those concerns from DHS very seriously, and that is part of the reason why we have agreed to this limited automatic stay of 14 days, basically so everybody can get their ducks in a row, and we can intelligently litigate the stay issue. And again, on the whole, we're going to be getting a quicker decision in these cases, which is beneficial to everybody.
I want to ask you a question. First of all, I heard Attorney York say this, and you've said it too, and I know that DOJ collaborated with SPD in this, and I'm guessing the Department of Health Services as well, to your colleague from there here in the courtroom as well. What do we do about Green, though? What do we do about our holding in Green? Like, you're not, this, there isn't a case in front of us right now that we can say, you know, we tried to, this is complicated, we tried to get it right, we missed it. It's still the, it's our most recent decision out there on this issue, and it's pretty clear, lay it out right in paragraph two, right? We conclude that because the state's significant pretrial interest in bringing a defendant who meets factors in cell, the competency for trial, providing timely justice to victims, outweighs upholding the defendant's liberty interest, refusing involuntary medication at the pretrial proceedings, Scott's automatic stay does not appeal to pretrial proceedings.
Yeah, this rule would supersede that language in Green. We do plan to have a note to the rule that would explain that, and I think it in particularly it says it acknowledges Green. And, you know, the other part I will say is Green is not completely a nullity because it still says that we can, under no circumstances, toll the 12-month clock. So
we're not going
to be able to undo that.
We will not come back here for that, that issue. So
that really was my question. We kind of started at the same time. So we're overruling Green by rule.
Yes.
Can you think of another time the court has overruled its case law that was recently decided? Even not recently decided, but this was within a couple of years by rule?
I don't have anything off the top of my head. No, I don't.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, you know, Green was a rolling back of the exercise of our superintending authority, which is a really dramatic thing for us to do in the first instance.
True.
And the removal of us acting in a certain circumstance via superintending authority doesn't preclude necessarily there being an actual rule or statute that governs a particular situation. In that sense, it wasn't like we were reading a statute. There was no statute. There was no process other than we had declared a, you know, at least there was an interpretation that we had declared a broad rule that, you know, exercising this authority, even though there was no statute saying so.
I think that's
so. In some ways, we're back to the world pre, you know, pre-Scott altogether for pretrial stuff when it comes to that, because there's just no rules or statutes or pleadings or procedure that was governing that kind of stuff other than the normal default stuff.
I think that's exactly right. And the way we phrased it in Green was really, I think we set out persuasively that there was a problem that maybe wasn't fully contemplated with the automatic stay, and we were looking for an equitable solution to that problem. I mean, we did want tolling, and so this was more of a consolation prize, limiting Scott in that way. So,
good try. Just kidding.
Do our best, yeah. If there are no other questions, I'll just quickly turn it over to my colleague. Thank you.
It pleases the court. Bob Kaiser from the Department of Justice, and I am very appreciative to the court allowing a trial lawyer to appear before you. I would have loved to have answered all the questions that you asked about trials. Many of you were trial judges, and you've seen these kinds of cases. I'm going to try to answer a couple of the questions that were raised. My experience has been in 30-some years trying cases in Wisconsin that in recent times, the number of offenders who can be deferred has increased to a great degree in many jurisdictions, which leaves us with a higher percentage of people who can't be, whether it's the seriousness of the offenses, that's the most important thing, or whether it's the criminal history of the offender. To a degree, that increases the percentage of cases that we see where the offender's mental health is, in fact, one of the issues we have to address. And I was very grateful when distinguished appellate lawyer Maura Whalen, who I'm sure you're all familiar with, asked if I would assist in this project with the Appellate Practice Subcommittee, Appellate Procedure Subcommittee, because of my experience both as a trial lawyer for many years, but also as an appellate lawyer many years ago. So what we have at the trial level then is courts, prosecutors, defense attorneys, who, as Judge Hagedorn pointed out, we don't do this every day. This isn't something where we have a routine procedure like we do for pleas or like we do for trials or like we do for sentencing. But on the other hand, it can't be something which is just simply given an hour at the end of a Friday. This is someone's mental health. This is someone's constitutional right to not be medicated if they oughtn't be. But there is no guidance. Last night I took an opportunity that we have at the Department of Justice to open up Books Unbound, we now have, I guess we're paying for that. So I got to look at CR 12 of Volume 1 of the Judicial Bench Book. And the most recent version that I looked at last night has Sell, Fitzgerald, Green, does a great job until it gets to the place where it says, and then they can appeal from the court order. And then there's not a word after that in the Judicial Bench Book where, at least I know I look, and I hope that the trial judges look also, to see where do we go. Who does what when now? And it's simply not there. So, as Attorney Jansen pointed out, we have 12 months. We tried to do something about it. We couldn't do anything about it. Once that commitment order is entered, we have 12 months to bring the defendant to competency. And the clock starts to run. And I will convey to you the distress that is felt at the trial level at the seeming lack of urgency at the appellate level when these appeals are brought. And yes, it's true. For whatever time y'all may have been in the trial courts, for many of the years that I was in the trial courts, since 2003 when Sell came down, we didn't know anything about it. And I feel badly about that because I've been training prosecutors about mental illness and the criminal law since the year 2000. But now the Public Defender's Office, and rightfully so, has said to us, your practice under this statute is unconstitutional. And they are going to appeal under Sell and the rules therein every single time they can. This rule allows us an opportunity to make a record, to give them an opportunity to see what to do with this record and whether or not it should be appealed. I certainly was an advocate for the tolling, suggested that a couple of times in Dane County when I had cases there since I've been in the Attorney General's office, and that didn't work. But, so I'm certainly grateful when Attorney Jansen was successful in the Green case from Dane County in having the automatic stay be overturned. But, and I acknowledge Attorney Bensky's presence here, the fact is this. In Sell, which is termed Sell versus United States, it was a federal case. And in the federal court, the Attorney General's office is the prosecutors, they run the prison system, and they run all the hospitals. We don't have that here. The prosecutors on the line are 72 individual district attorney's offices and the Attorney General's office. The Department of Human Services that takes care of these people is a separate department. And, of course, the prison system is its own system. So we don't have the reasonable amount of time that the federal courts had in Sell to bring a person to competency. We have 12 months until and unless the statute maybe would be changed someday. But that's the rule. And so the question becomes, as Attorney Bensky brought it to our attention, the doctors for whom she is responsible say to her, it's inhuman to get an order to stick a needle in somebody's arm, then get an order to say, no, don't stick a needle in their arm, then get an order to say, that order's been lifted, stick a needle back in their arm. And as much as I am cognizant of this 12 months, because it has run on me on serious cases, right now a murder case, not mine, but one on which I'm advising, because that's what I do in my job, and this person is Chapter 51. But the 14 days does three important things. It gives us time. It gives the attorney time to talk to their client. And let's all be cognizant of the fact that these clients may not be the easiest people to have a conversation with. Secondly, it gives the time, as we were, as you discussed with Attorney York, to prepare the transcript. Why is that important? Well, that's important because the persons in the appellate division of the public defender's office who are deciding whether or not to appeal, they weren't the trial lawyer. They don't know anything. Mm-hmm. So they have to either accept the trial defense attorney's summation of what all happened or have a transcript, and we'll have the transcript done. But in my mind, most importantly, and the reason the Department of Justice agreed to this in spite of Attorney Jansen's success in the Green case, is it's consistent with the reality of the human condition and the need to not medicate people and unmedicate people. What we have is the opportunity, by the way, just one other reality that we deal with is people don't get to Mendota the next day. There isn't enough beds in Mendota to get somebody to Mendota the next day. And jails don't medicate people for involuntary medication, don't involuntarily medicate people solely for the purpose of bringing them to competency. So that's the reality. That's the reason for it. The appeal has to be expedited. We can't wait 2.5 years for somebody to decide whether or not this medication order will or will not be abided by. The rule of cell is one that the courts can follow. It is one that the public defenders have trained their people about, that Attorney Jansen and I have trained the prosecutors about, it can and will be followed. But right now, there is no cognizance of what to do next after CR 206 is signed. And that's what this rule does, and we're asking you to please adopt the rule.
I have some questions about the 75231 requested amendment. Is Judge Cruz, are you planning on talking to us too? Or
I wasn't planning.
If you could, I think that's probably the best person to ask, right? I don't want to, if anyone else, I don't want to, do other people have questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
we're not quite sure, and we say to that in the memorandum in support of the petition, it is unclear to us whether this court in its rulemaking authority can order this type of appeal to be decided by one judge or not, or we have to take it up concurrently with the legislature, which we're prepared to do.
Okay.
We're just not certain about that because we had a lot of discussion about it, but we frankly, candidly, are seeking direction from this court.
I'm not sure we can. But is the request that we do this piece first, though?
Yes.
Because of the small amount of appeals we're even talking about here, and if it's really unworkable or untenable, then I'm sure you'll let us know.
Right. That was the intent. We did discuss that. If this petition is adopted, it gives us the pretty clear entree to approach, I think, a group that's not going to really have much of a vested interest in not making that change that we think is necessary.
Okay.
What do you think?
About what?
About the question.
What?
If you were on this side of the,
seconds.
If you were on,
right.
And you had to consider the question. I understand that as a committee and those sorts of things, but you know, you're not taking a position. There's arguments potentially on either side. But what's your view?
I would do an extensive research of 752 chapter 752 authority and whether the court has to. I've not done that. Obviously, as a matter of expediency, it would be nice to get it done concurrently by the court itself. I just haven't concluded definitively whether the authority is there or not. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I have an additional question.
Sure.
There's a sense of collaboration here, which I really commend. How wonderful, right? And this collaborative effort is asking us to move in a direction that some way reflects upon Green. And so there's an institutional concern. I'm not sure how this petition reflects on Green. Is it overruling? Is it backtracking a bit? Could you...
Is it adopting the dissent as now the majority?
I quite honestly, I think Justice Hagedorn hit the nail on the head. This is a continuation of the court's superintending authority. And that was the determination made in Green. that required the parties to follow this procedure and practice for various reasons. And all we've tried to do collaboratively is to say, we understand the court's decision there. We're not disagreeing with it per se. We just think that at the end of the day, this will be a more efficient and productive procedure to follow, respecting the rights that were under consideration in Green. But the court's going to be doing it by a rules petition. To answer Chief Justice Ziegler's question, I'm not aware of an instance when this has been done before. But again, I think it's just part and parcel of the court's superintending authority. Thank you.
One of the things that the rule does, the proposed rule does, is it gives notice to the Department of Human Services by rule that this has all gone down. And that doesn't happen right now. So they're getting this patient to care for, and unless somebody tells them that it's happening, when they get the court order, they don't know that this has gone down. So that they can know who to contact, so that they can know who to be in touch with, so that they can know that we can now manage this person. Is there going to be a stay? Isn't there going to be a stay? So it's an important part of the rule for them to have that, because as I said, they're not part of our department. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Anyone else wish to be heard on this matter? All right. Then we will conclude 2305, and the courtroom will be set up for open administrative conference, and we will come back out shortly on both matters.